Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm sorry, we've got to start all over again. Our mic was down, and what we're saying is tonight is June the 23rd, 2020, Ralph Pointer, What's Happening? And we're talking about an analysis of oppression tonight, and what we are saying is that the outpourings of the people's rage is more about the slow death of the American dream than about the slow death of George Floyd. We apologize for the delay. Our call-in number is 347-857-3293. And tonight, as I said, is Tuesday, June 23rd. So without further ado, Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
As I was saying, every week I read what I believe, and it becomes more real every day. What I believe, April 2015. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered, except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black move lynching indoors. The police as the army of occupation have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media, and because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us in our community, do not matter to us, the people. Our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. And this program is dedicated to those who have been imprisoned by using self-defense. And then it has extended to all of those who resist the government, who have been incarcerated, who have been attacked, who have been fired from their jobs, all for reaching out to truth and justice. And so when we say political prisoners, it includes a whole host of people, and as we have been saying, it's going to include more, because anybody who resists is considered a terrorist by this government. And in line with our opening statement, austerity marches onwards with hospital closures, the decline in social spending, housing, education, and tax laws that support the wealthy. And the so-called leftist political party, Democrats, out-Republican the Republicans, with alternatives to Trump with Biden, Cuomo, and a host of to the right of the middle candidates with little threatening alternatives. Big money supports more of the same, which is extremely depressing. Hopefully, out of this visible discontent, something positive and concrete toward momentous structural change can be realized. Let's go to work together to develop the fist necessary to stop this corrupt, gargantuan machine from devouring us all. And with that said, let us go to Sister Betty, who will have some positive thoughts for us out of this situation.
I'm sure all of you are aware that several of our political prisoners are dying from the COVID-19, let's call it germ warfare. I know the history of the march of the Europeans across the globe, starting from when they first came out of that continent called Europe, and I'm just going to call it the death sentence of genocide. And if it's not deliberate genocide, it's genocide in effect because of the conditions of the oppressed under capitalism and imperialism. So without further ado, we want to turn our mic over to someone I just think is so awesome and gives me hope for the future, and that is our wonderful poet of the evening. I'm going to try and open up her mic, and we're going to say Sister Sarah Adams from Rochester, a student. Your mic is open.
Hi, so today I'm going to be reading a poem that my sixth grade teacher actually wrote. He wrote it for a Black History Assembly that we had, and it just really stuck with me, so I'm going to read that. And he also is one who got me into poetry to begin with, so I'm just going to read this poem from my sixth grade teacher.
Go ahead.
For hundreds of years, we were told otherwise. Our beautiful history they tried to disguise. From myths and stereotypes to judgments and jokes, attempts to erase the truth were constantly spoke. Still we stood with our integrity sound, our bodies strong and solid with 10 toes to the ground. As time progressed, and history too, equality became the chant that supposedly leveled me and you. Despite losing the chains off our necks and backs, the words of equality didn't cut us any slack. The new age was different, yes, for some, but we still saw hate each day when going to and from. So, yes, part of our history is like a painful cut from a cleaver, but that hasn't stopped us from reclaiming it either. So let us never forget, our history is so much more than slave ships and segregation and athletic scores. For those who don't know what being black truly means, listen to these next words from us kings and queens. Black is beautiful. Our skin is too. The melanin radiates such diverse hues. Black is beautiful. We are proud of who we are, our eternal rallying cry. Black is beautiful in America and Africa alike. There's no single black experience that combines the journey we hike. Black is beautiful. Since the birth of humanity, we built this and so much more. So pay attention and see. Black is beautiful. Black is beautiful. Black is beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And with teachers like that, our youth will be saved. But let me forewarn you, I have many teachers like that who speak truth to those who need it the most, our students. And as a person who began teaching in 1957. And one of the statements I made at the time, that education has been taken over by the incompetent and greedy. And I stand by that statement that I made so many years ago. That was after the first year of teaching in the Pittsburgh school system. Thank you, Sister Sarah. We look forward to your continuing the tradition that was brought on by our dear sister, Lynn Stewart. Say hello to your folks for us. Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. And as I said in the beginning of the program, we're sorry for the delay. We didn't realize there was a problem with our microphones. One of the things we're saying is that the outpouring of the people reflects their rage at the viciousness of capitalism as it is imposed upon the people. Brother Ralph and I were discussing the latest news about COVID-19, how because the nursing homes are being offered more for patients who are suffering from COVID-19, they're literally putting patients in the nursing home out on the street, sometimes without even knowing fighting their family. To date, I believe it's 6,000 plus in 8 to 9 states. Many of them are suffering with Alzheimer's, are totally unable to make sound judgments, and they're just being put out, notified that they can go to a shelter, a homeless shelter, so that the nursing homes can make a cash killing with the reimbursement they're getting from the government for COVID-19 patients. Without further ado, we want to start the way we ended. We want to start with Brother Joel. And we see Sister Belinda and a whole list of people in the queue, and we will get to everybody tonight. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you much clearer this week. Thank you so much, Joel.
Okay, I understand last week it wasn't coming through very well, and it was not easy to comprehend what I was saying. Anyway, I'm continuing now, actually repeating the news that I was bringing to last week's discussion. And this is this jumps off of a New York Times article on the front page above the fold on June 10th, 2020. And they're talking about the face-off between protesters and various repressive forces that the administration had mobilized to rough the protesters up, remove them from a certain area, and then have Trump march through so that he could pose with a Bible from a church that was across Lafayette Park, which people who have experience demonstrating in Washington, D.C. know that that's a park that's directly across the street from the White House. Now, in the first paragraph of that article, there's something that jumped off the page at me. And maybe somebody could tell me that my estimation of its meaning is wrong. But it says here that a white National Guard commander called the standoff in Lafayette Park the Alamo, implying that the White House was under siege. Now, people should know that there was a battle against Mexico in which a great deal of Mexican territory was stolen and became the western part of the United States. And one of the battles that the initially that the U.S. had actually lost was the Alamo, which was a hotel in Texas, which at that time belonged to Mexico. And incidentally, the war and the motivation for ripping Texas off Mexico was that United States citizens, or whatever you might call them, had settled in Texas and brought their slaves into Texas. And then Mexico outlawed slavery. And that's how that war began. The United States considered that an outrage and mobilized to rip Texas and several other states, including California, the most populous state now, away from Mexico. It had all belonged to Mexico. So let me continue this paragraph here. It says, black members of the D.C. Guard objected to turning on their neighbors. Now, later in the article explained that the National Guard there was from D.C., and a lot of them knew the protesters personally and, of course, agreed with them. They were protesting the racism exemplified in the blatant, brutal murder of George Floyd. So there was a certain degree of sympathy between the National Guard and the regular people. And by the way, that's how revolutions take place very often. The army, the armed forces that the ruling class depends on to keep everyone at gunpoint so that they can own the lion's share of the property and extract the lion's share of the value of what the working people produce. Anyway, so it says here that the black members of the D.C. Guard objected to turning on their neighbors. It says, army leaders, it says, told pilots to flood the box with everything we have as two helicopters buzzed protesters in the streets. And I've checked with several people that I know that have been in the military, and they said that when they say flood the box, it means maximum firepower. So this sounds like some army leaders, as it calls it, probably involving Trump himself. But it says army leaders told pilots to flood the box with everything we have. And remember, before that, black members of the D.C. Guard objected to turning on their neighbors. So it sounds to me as if orders went out on some level to fire on the demonstrators below. And these helicopters, as combat helicopters, ones that would be subjected to orders like flood the box with everything we have, are very capable of, for example, flooding an entire football field with bullets, I think, in every square foot in a 20-second period. So these are very, very dangerous and deadly weaponized helicopters that were floating above. Fortunately, the orders apparently were not obeyed. And if they had been obeyed, there would have been a massacre as hadn't been seen perhaps since the Tulsa massacre, which was also assisted by aircraft. I understand it was the first time that aircraft ever dropped explosives on civilians below. So
thank you, Joel.
This is
quite a report. Are you close to summing up?
I want to get in one other thing, and then I'll leave that at calling attention to it. People should look at the June 10th, 2020 New York Times for that article. But I also wanted to make one comment, which I think that what's afoot with the slogan of dismantle the police and defund the police, which has been echoed now by many mayors and governors and other establishment figures in a way startlingly, but I think the meaning of it is being missed, that it's a step towards privatizing the police and bringing in some kind of a mechanism under the police circumstances, similar to replacing the public schools with charter schools and privatizing the police, distancing themselves from the political establishment so that, for example, if the police do something like the murder of George Floyd, the animus would go against some contractor that the city government had contracted with, and placing another layer of separation from the police. And at the same time, some of the bourgeois newspapers have been unusually complaining about the police unions. Well, that's what they did with the charter schools. They got the teachers' unions out, and they privatized a lot of those schools and specialized with them and even gave it a coding of something that gave the illusion of community control. So I think that they want to do the same thing with the police, to privatize them, and that's what they mean by defunding and even dismantling, that they want to reconstitute the police forces in a charter school kind of way, as they did with the schools.
All right, Joel, thank you so much for that, and that's so much that many of us have to look out for. When they start talking about change from the top, it's not really change at all. We must be. And I often wondered where this call came from, defunding the police. We will keep watching it. Thanks again, Joel.
Brother Joel, did you say that New York Times article was June 10th, 2020?
June 10th, 2020. And it's on page one. And the headline, you could also look it up online, of course, and the headline is, if you want the headline, it's Aggressive Tactics by National Guard Ordered to Appease Trump, Wounded the Military, too.
Oh, thank you so much. Without further ado, we're going to go for an update from Louisiana United, and we want people to understand that most of the people that we have on this broadcast, even the ones who call in, have a certain analysis and a perspective about oppression. They know something is wrong, and they speak about it from the point of view of a solution. So, Joel, stay on top of that information, and feel free to keep us updated on that. Sister Belinda, we can give you a few moments this evening to give us an update, and be sure to announce your latest webinar that's coming up if you want the public to tune into it.
Hello, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, thank y'all so much. Yeah, we just had our webinar on this evening, and it was phenomenal. Just impact with young people that participated, and why it is so important that they understand what it's going to take in order for us to win and participate with the elderly or older people that are wise and that can basically impart, you know, our instructions and directions on this movement. So, which they are so hyped and fired up and, you know, they have so much energy. And I'm so excited about the fact that they feel like they have to be a part of this historic moment and that they refuse to back down in regards to what it's going to take in order for us to, you know, win and be victorious in getting justice and making history in our country today, Sister Betty. So I'm so excited to have the young people on fire and involved with Louisiana United International. They just started their own project. They're calling it The Project for Revolution, and I think that is an awesome title for what they're saying, to gather and bring all the young people together to the forefront to lead us into this, you know, dynamic change that's going to take place. So, and that comes, that, you know, you already know, Sister Betty, you're on the cutting edge of how important it is for young people to be engaged and involved with this type of movement. But I just want to give you a brief update on, you know, what's happening with Reverend Pinckney. With Pastor Victor, and, you know, and in regards to him being a political prisoner. You know, when you said in the beginning is that, you know, they're not really telling us the truth about how many people are dying in our prisons in regards to this COVID-19. Louisiana is notorious for what they're doing here. They're not telling us the truth. They are, you know, basically got it all covered up, and they got things just exactly the way they want it with their operations and how they don't want the public oversight to be involved with how they're making decisions on how people are being treated inside of these prisons. So in regards to that, you know, our position statement was that you have already determined that it's better that these people die of the COVID-19 inside of these prisons and jails, instead of you evacuating the prisons and reducing the population. So we had a protest with over 200 people that showed up on the gates of Angola here in Louisiana. And I'm here to tell you that it was phenomenal. It was awesome. You know, the family members came out and stood with us, Sister Betty. We marched about 2 miles from the gate, I mean, from the street all the way up to the gate of Angola Prison. And, you know, we had an opportunity to have a rally with people speaking in regards to, you know, their stories and how their loved ones, you know, are suffering inside of the prisons, and that, you know, that, and begging and pleading that, you know, we're not going to go away. We're not going to stop fighting for until we get them free. So I just wanted to give that update. And then I'm also looking forward to, you know, Pastor Victor coming home. You know, we are in the highest court right now, and we hope to have some good news within the next few days or so in regards to Pastor Pinckney. And I would definitely let you and Brother Raph be the first to know on the list that when his release. Okay? So thank you so much for that.
Sure. In Angola, in Louisiana, and I want everybody to understand that struggle to bring a little justice to Angola's prison, which is no more than a plantation slave camp with a legal stamping on it, has been going on since Angola prison, Angola plantation was turned into the word prison. The
yes.
Honorable Josiah Marcus Garvey had big movements down in Louisiana on Angola, and as you can see, with Sister Belinda Parker Brown, it has not been solved, and it is up to us to jump all over that 13th Amendment and make the abolishment of slavery real in America.
Absolutely.
You
know, and one more thing, Brother Ralph, with that. We protest on June 19th so that people won't fall for the hype and the lie about freedom, you know, because we declared that day on the gates of Angola that, you know, slavery is alive and well here in the state of Louisiana, and we wanted the world to know that. Thank you.
And that's what the codes were all about, to reverse the so-called freedom of the slaves, make up a new slavery. They made it up, and they made it up quick, and it is our job to disband that slavery that still exists in America. Sister Betty.
Again, Sister Belinda, please keep us updated. We want everyone to know that the pastor she describes, Reverend Victor, he tried to bring financial reclamation to the people of New Orleans. And you need to know your Ida B. Wells. Most of the men who were lynched in the South were successful businessmen who were in competition with their white counterparts for the black population's dollar. So it's about capitalism, and capitalism cannot afford for the slave to buy their freedom and free other slaves. And that's basically why Reverend Victor has been destroyed. And not only was he destroyed, a whole community was destroyed after the hurricane. And that's what Sister Belinda is trying to alert you to, that history of slavery is still real. It has not changed. Thank you, Sister.
And there has never been a federal law against lynching, economic or physical lynching. It's all the same, and it's still in the courts, and the courts are going too slow. I think 150 years is more than enough. We must intercede, and we can begin with supporting Reverend Victor with the help of Linda Parker Brown.
And
thank
Louisiana
you.
United. Again, people, please research Louisiana United International. Tell other advocates for freedom and prisoners and the incarcerated about her program. We need to unite behind this struggle in Louisiana against the death camp of Angola. Without further ado, we're going to open the mic of a sister who is the head of Jericho in New York, who is a stalwart fighter and knows what an inside of a jail looks like personally. But before we go to that, I just wanted to give you an article that was referred to me by one of our warriors in California. It's from The Intercept, and it's called about the Brooklyn coronavirus. And a federal judge last week denied a request by people held in the federal jail in Brooklyn to order officials to improve their efforts to prevent a coronavirus outbreak in the facility. The incarcerated people have alleged a level of medical neglect at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn that rose to the degree of unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment. They sought a temporary injunction ordering jail officials to improve medical care and disease prevention at the jail, as well as appointing a special master empowered to oversee those changes. Judge Rachel Kovner ruled against this request, finding that the people held at MDC Brooklyn had failed to show that jail officials had displayed deliberate indifference to a substantial risk of serious harm, the so-called legal standard for constitutional violations in this sort of case. So Sister Ann has been reporting these statistics to us on a national level. Sister Belinda has been showing how death camp leads the way. What we want you to do is to connect the dots. capitalism and genocide. So, Sister Ann, mic is open.
Thank you so much, Sister Betty. Well, you couldn't have said it any better. Capitalism, genocide go hand in hand, that's for sure. I also did see some excellent reports about what the sister from Louisiana was talking about on Facebook, where they had pictures and everything of the people marching up to the prison gates. Really good. Looked really fantastic. So I just wanted to say I did see that. And also that article you were quoting from, it's amazing. This is the same thing they do when anybody asks for a writ of habeas corpus. That's their excuse, that you haven't proven the part of the law, which is really subjective, of saying that something is deliberate or not, right? How can you prove deliberate indifference? It's very sticky, you know, same thing they did to Jaleel when he had the HAVE to try to be temporarily released so he would not get COVID-19, which he since has gotten. And he is slowly recovering from, we're happy to report. I just got an email from him, a couple of emails today. I won't read all of it, but this is something new that happened this morning. He says, this morning I was awakened.
And let me interrupt you to say to everyone listening, we have extended the program because we had essential information that we felt the participants should hear about. And so hang tight. We extended. We have a whole program to go. Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, great. That's fantastic. So Jaleel says, this morning I was wakened and informed that I was going on a trip. They took me to Ellenville Hospital for a sonogram on my thyroid. Apparently, the blood draw last week indicated my thyroid is not functioning as it should be. No one told me the results of the blood test prior to being taken to the outside hospital. And in fact, I learned my reason for being there for the sonogram is from the result of blood tests when I got to the outside hospital, meaning the original outside hospital in Albany. I'll be going to sick call this morning to learn exactly how much more damage COVID-19 has done to my body. I did not have any thyroid problems prior to being infected. Okay, now let me get the next one. There's two. Because then he gave me a later report, which came in just as the program was starting. He says, I have since learned that I have an overactive hyperthyroid gland. They prescribed for me to take a drug called methimazole, 5 milligrams three times a day. I know very little about an overactive thyroid or this drug and its negative side effects, so I'm concerned about both. I did write the doctor and ask for a consult and to be scheduled for a biopsy to ensure the thyroid is benign. So this is something new in addition to the damage to his lung and the slow recovery, thank goodness, of his kidneys, which do seem to be recovering. We now have this as well. I did just send him a whole Mayo Clinic report on this particular drug, which does have a lot of strange side effects and interactions with other drugs. So that's the latest that from Jaleel, and that's from today. So that's what's happening with him in the death camps. Now, I know, Ralph, you sent me the news, which I had also sent out about Ed Poindexter and the struggle for some form of what we would call compassionate release. That's very hopeful, but those people in Nebraska have been horrible. You know, they have never granted either Ed or Mondo, when he was still alive, any kind of, you know, relief. You know, they at one time had won the point that, you know, they were tried, you know, unconstitutionally, and then that was overturned on appeal. You know, it's those Nebraska people are really horrible, but it did sound positive from what we read, and we have to really thank Michael Richardson, who has been pushing this for a long time. He's the one who wrote the book about the Omaha 2, and he knows them very well. And, you know, Ed has been in prison for 50 years for a crime that he totally did not commit, has always maintained his innocence, as well as Mondo, who we lost a few years ago. And it would really be wonderful to get him out of there. You know, the situation is not good. As you were saying earlier, Ralph, a lot of our people are quite ill and are, you know, possibly going to die in there, which we're really trying hard to not have happen. So, you know, it's really difficult. So that's one case that there might be a little light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm going to get in touch with Michael Richardson and others out in Omaha and see what we can do, if anything, to help this effort. You know, do they want to start a campaign? Do they want to get people to sign on? You know, what do they need? And then we'll let people know immediate amount. Also, earlier today, I spoke with Kasise Siddiqui, Kamal Siddiqui's daughter, because, as you know, he was taken to an outside hospital on June 14th. Now they have been calling, not only her, but she and other members of her family and friends, close friends, have been calling and calling and calling. And apparently, according to the prison, he's back at the prison. But he has not made a phone call. He has not sent an email. So, you know, Casissa is very concerned because she said, you know, that's not like her dad. He always wants to inform them, you know, what's going on with him. So they don't know if it's really true that, A, he is back at the prison, although I would assume he probably is if they're saying that. But why does he not have access to a phone? Why does he not have access to his little iPad or whatever it is they use, you know, to send the emails by JPay? So I said to her, you know, anything we can do, let us know. You know, if you need to start a campaign, we can have lots of people calling the prison. You know, you can write a little script, what you want people to say. We can put it out there. And if that's what it takes, I said, you know, unfortunately, many times, that is what it takes, just to find out how somebody is, you know, how, you know, they don't even know, did he actually have surgery in this outside hospital? He was possibly going to have some kind of vascular surgery on his leg. So they have not heard. So, you know, she and her mom and other folk have been calling and calling. And, you know, it's very frustrating and really horrible when your family, you know, your loved one is inside and you can't find out any information. So in between busy or they don't pick up.
That's why we call them death camps. And
they are
his
death camps, absolutely. No question.
Mongo Waylanga, great poet.
Mondo. Mondo died inside, and Mondo's a great poet and artist, among other things. Ed has been a fantastic mentor to hundreds and hundreds of young people inside, just as many of our Black Panther Party and other political prisoners have been over the years and continue to be. And,
but I have to have you...
Another one, the young people call him Pops. You know, he reads all their letters for them and stuff because a lot of them are functionally illiterate.
Thank you for that.
One of the things we want to task arrange for a family members to call in one night. It would be nice to hear it from the horse's mouth. I know you are the conduit for the movement for New York City Jericho, but I would appreciate it if you could get a group of the family members.
I will definitely ask them if they would want to do it, and then I'll let you know ahead of time what their phone numbers are and everything
they have to do a perp walk for lawyers, but Sister Lynn did not believe in doing the perp walk. She said, if they're kicking me in the stomach, I want somebody to kick back, and I want them to know they're kicking me in the stomach. So we want to follow Sister Lynn, and we'll charge you with that. Without further ado, we're going to go to Sister Dolores, one of our stalwarts, investigators, and analyzers of the whole issue of oppression. Sister Dolores, your mic is open. And Sister Ann, we can never thank you and Sister Belinda enough. Go ahead, Sister Dolores.
Hi, everybody. A couple of days ago, I heard a very brief comment made about the Texas Board of Education, which dictates which school books in the country get published and distributed. And I remember talking to Sam Anderson a couple of years ago about, and he mentioned this to me. And, you know, with them being in control, the Texas Board of Ed, of course, this determines whose history gets told and what truths get told in the classroom. And I don't remember if I heard the comment about the Texas Board of Ed and the school books last week. If it was I think it was in the context of this quote unquote new movement, wherein white folks are suddenly discovering the 400 years of Black history regarding police violence and the protest marches now, and Juneteenth and Tulsa, Oklahoma, etc. But I'm sure that most, if not all, Black professors have been aware of the Texas school books selections for quite some time. I don't think it's anything new to Black professors.
I started teaching in 1957, and it was an issue then. Because the
no
people
kidding.
Who buy...
No kidding, back then. Oh, my goodness, my goodness. And Sam and I also talked about the small percentage of black students admitted to Stuyvesant High School and what's that and what that's all about. And the shortage of black teachers, particularly male teachers. And I remember when I went to I grew up in Ocean Hill in Brooklyn, and I never had a black teacher from first grade through high school, you know, and I went to Franklin K. Lane High School in Jamaica, and you know elementary school in Ocean Hill. But even in Franklin K. Lane, I never had a black teacher. And I remember that having heard years later after I graduated that there was a race riot because black students were going to Franklin, had started going to Franklin K. Lane High School. And the white community was objecting to the fact that blacks were coming into, quote-unquote, their community. No. And you know, it's just incredible. Also, I remember when I was going to Lane that when we were leaving, when school was out, we were leaving, some of the students went into this candy store on the corner where the L steps are. And there was always a policeman there at the foot of the steps going up to catch the, you know, the train, the subway train. And he herded us, one by one, all us black students, up that subway stairs and out of Jamaica. You know, I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, just, I still remember that, you know, like decades later. And then I went to Brooklyn College. And when I went to Brooklyn College, half of my instructors were wearing yarmulkes, okay? And I felt the whole time like I was in a private yeshiva out in Long Island, you know. And one day on campus, I saw a group of black students coming in through the gate, and there were a couple of adults with them. And I happened to pass by these two white students who were talking to each other on campus, and they looked up and they saw these black students coming in. And one of them said, "Oh, my God, we're being invaded," okay? And it was like, and I still remember that. I mean, it was just incredible, you know. That's, you know, one of Trump's favorite words, too, when he's talking about the Mexicans coming here. But this was back then, you know, and I think these might have been Sikh students that were coming in to the campus, maybe, you know,
that
going on.
That has been the story of education throughout American history, this whole question
yes.
of what.
Oh, my
races.
Gosh.
I
and,
remember times, and it is a symptom of the system we live in. And that's why they found community control a threat to them. We said, we're not going to bother you with your schools. What we're going to do is develop our own schools in our own neighborhoods with our own money. And when the school system's fine, you're going to want to come to our schools because it's in the book. If you don't teach the black students, it's soon going to transfer to the white students. It has happened. The schools are dying. And...
yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Dolores. And so we're going
to
go on.
And, you know, I remember when I went to Brooklyn College, tuition was free. And now I'm hearing all these politicians talking about, you know, free college education, whatever. But I think that when, you know, these students that were coming, these black students that were coming through the gate, you know, there might have been Sikh students. And then shortly thereafter, when more black students started attending CUNY, all of a sudden, no more tuition. Tuition ended. Free tuition ended in 1976, you know. And it's just incredible. So
you hit the nail on the head. It used to be free tuition in the New York system, but when black students started attending the universities in small numbers, they
yes,
change
numbers.
That.
Mm-hmm.
But I also
think
we have. We got to wind it up, Doris. Do you have a few more comments?
Yeah, I do. Maybe I'll save them to next week because you said you have like a long list of folks.
Follow up. Thank you, Joel. Yes, that's fantastic. One of the things
okay,
we recognize is that along with the emergence of the black middle class, the black misleadership class followed suit. And the black politicians in Brooklyn, from my point of view, are as much to blame for decentralization, which was not community control, as the white imperialist state structure. Let's be clear about that. James is why Jahlil Muntakim is still in prison. Trish James. And Obama was responsible. So while I know there is racism, they could not be as effective if it were not for metaphysical imperialism. Stephen Biko, the weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed.
And they have the gatekeepers. Yeah. We have so many of the gatekeepers. Won't go into them. I always get angry. But we must take some responsibility ourselves. We are the movement, and I, for one, gave up on electoral politics.
Here's someone who did not give up on electoral politics. Here's someone who's strong and fights back. Gwen, your mic is open. And thank you, Sister Dolores, and give us an update. You and Joel have homework to come back next
week.
Okay,
will do.
Follow up on
all
your
giving us history that has been forgotten.
Sister Gwen, your mic is open.
So, pow, today was election day. And I went down and I looked at the list, and it looked like I was looking in the toilet. So this is what I did. I don't give up my right to vote. I know I'm a better candidate than everybody on there, and I'm not running any campaigns for me. I don't run for office for me. But I recognize that there is just year after year after year, the same people, the same modus operandum, and they really are about them. And so I voted for the one person I went down for, and I voted for Bernie because I wanted him to be able to make a statement at the primary. And then I wrote in every box me. I wrote it for Gwen. I voted for Gwen in every box. I put her name in every single box.
Fantastic.
I don't want to waste my vote, okay? So I know that is really, really jaded. But honestly, I've known these people that are running for years and years and years. These are the very reason why we are where we're at. They all have amnesia. They get up there and they do these speeches about what's going on. They always have to do a speech when something like, Black Lives Matter happens. Well, they better get their ass up there and say something. Except for they are the ones that created the situation. They are the ones that helped to gentrify the community. I mean, and I think that people don't realize, again, that things that sound very boring, like zoning changes, are extraordinarily impactful. If you didn't allow these zoning changes to happen, then you would not be able to knock down neighborhoods in one foul swoop like they're doing. So even though it doesn't seem like a sexy issue, it's been used, it's been weaponized to remove entire segments of the population. And that's why things that don't seem so sexy on the outside are extraordinarily important. And that's why it's been at the centerpiece of all of the races I've had is these zoning issues. I was listening to A.M. Stern the other night on PBS. You probably don't know who he is, but he's one of the leading architects in New York City, and I didn't know who he was either until he wrote a fabulous support letter for me for PS109. We were trying to save PS109. And he was speaking on TV the other night about the high-rises and how utterly boring they are. How when you look at these new glass high-rises, your eye looks up at it once, gets bored, and goes back down and continues to move on. And the thing about these high-rises is they're not just boring, but they tear apart neighborhoods and they get rid of people and they clean everything up and they're very cold and they don't bring community into a neighborhood. They kind of move community out of the neighborhood. So I think that, you know, I think that things that appear to be trite to other people, I don't think are trite. I think that where you live and what your community looks like, the buildings that are there, I think they're really important. I think that people's hearts are in their communities, and churches and buildings that have been there for, you know, hundreds of years, I think that means something to community. And I think that when you tear entire blocks down, like we're doing all over New York City, and you put up these very cold, ugly buildings that are extraordinarily boring, I think that people kind of lose interest in being in a community. I don't even think they feel like they're in a community anymore. So I don't know. I'm just rambling on about that. Now I'm going to give you one more zinger so people can poke fun at me about. But I had a conversation with two women this week, and I think these are two women that don't know me at all, and they don't even know that I ran for public office. And the subject came up of daycare. And I think they consider themselves to be liberals. Well, I consider myself to be much more than liberal. I consider myself to be way over to the left. But I also consider myself to be a person of common sense. And so as I look around at what we're doing in the world and how fast the planet's moving, and now that, you know, as soon as you have your kid, you got to take that kid over to the daycare center and stick them in there with 25 other kids. And these, we're talking about babies that are, you know, literally weeks old, up to 6 months. That's where we're starting. And then when I look at this and I see all the babies in the 25 carriages with two 20-year-olds taking care of them, they look like little turkeys all lined up, and then they're going to take them out. And, you know, I think there's something really wrong with that. I think I call these institutions. And I think what people don't think about is that while you're not raising your child, you are allowing your government to raise your child. And you're allowing your government to instill all kinds of their morals into your children, because you're not doing it. You're basically an absentee parent. Now, I'm not blaming the parents, because I realize we live in a situation today where both parents usually have to work. But once in a while, both parents don't have to work, especially in a place like Manhattan where there's a lot of really, really wealthy people. It's just that people just want to work. It's just more fun to go to work than change diapers. But the thing is, you know, children, I don't think, are just as resilient as people make them out to be. I think it matters to them. I think that kids have a terrible separation anxiety, and that all marks for what their personality is going to be when they grow up. And so, you know, I guess I got lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones that was able to have a mother home as I grew up, and most of the kids in my neighborhoods had their mother there, and we all took it really for granted. We never even thought about it. But I look at the way, yes, I'm going to let it go. I'm going to let you go. I'll just wrap up with this, saying that maybe these ideas sound old-fashioned. But some ideas that are old-fashioned have a lot of validity and value. And I certainly think that these old-fashioned ideas work very well and very nicely with the new ideas that are going on today and going left in the future. So I'm just going to leave you with that, and you can bang that around for a while.
Well, it's a great discussion for another day. It is a very important discussion, but that's capitalism. You got to have. Most people go to work not for luxuries, but just to pay the rent and get a few groceries. And so
that's because our wages have been knocked down to nothing. That's because we are making no money. And so, you know, rather than capitulate to the system, I think we need to insist that the system start paying us what our time is actually worth and stop working for less than 40 hours a week and for no money. You're right, Ralph. It's a much bigger picture than that.
Very important. But thanks again, Gwen. And
you're
next
welcome.
Up. Okay, see you, Gwen. 4295.
Paul, before we get to Paul Gilman, I want to say to Gwen, I want you to come back next week with more of a discussion about the districts and the changing of district lines and how that has been weaponized in a capitalist structure, everything they do can become a because you don't have a party system and you don't have people who represent you to fight against them weaponizing law against you. That's what happens in capitalism.
Yes, that is.
Thanks again, Gwen. Next up.
You're welcome.
4295, Paul Gilman. Your mic is open.
Hi, Brother Ralph, Sister Betty. Great talking to you as usual. This is Paul Gilman from the Bronx Greens. And Friday, June 26th, this Friday, the Bronx Greens will be sponsoring a vigil and teach-in in Union Square in support of American Indian Movement political prisoner Leonard Peltier. I'd like to give a shout-out to Ann Land and the Jericho Movement. You know, go to their website. They're pretty cool. They're big supporters of Leonard Peltier. And, you know, Leonard, for those who don't know, Leonard Peltier was a supporter of American Indian Movement protecting traditional Indians on the reservation who were being murdered by an FBI death squad. From 1970 to 74, 62 Native Americans on Pine Ridge Reservation were murdered and no investigation, nothing. And that area is jurisdiction of the FBI. So AIM, American Indian Movement, came to protect them. The traditionals, they were camped on the Jumping Bull property. There was a shootout between the death squads and the AIM supporters. And out of the blue, the FBI decided to send these two agents on a chase of another Indian, Arlo Looking Glass, who stole a pair of cowboy boots. They said, go chase him. He went up this road. The road led right into the shootout where, you know, someone shot their tire out. They came out with their guns blazing, and next thing you know, these two agents were killed. I'm sorry they were killed. That was sad. But this was a situation where it was a shootout. Nobody knew who they were, who was who. Could have been anybody who shot them. And they needed a scapegoat. And Leonard Peltier, who was there, but he was one of something around 50 people there, was falsely convicted of killing these FBI agents. They want, you know, the whole point of this was that they, capitalism, we're talking about capitalism, you know, they wanted to bust up the reservation, give everyone some money, you know, $40,000-$50,000 for the plots, but the traditionals said no because this is all we have. The reason they wanted to bust up the reservation because there's coal and uranium on it, more toxins that they want to inflict, and the Lakota people want to keep their, you know, they want improvements. They want more, you know, I mean, it's really a rough place to live as it is. There's very little water. You can't really grow anything there because these are the same people that defeated Custard. You know, when they were finally settled, they were given one of the worst reservations in the country. And, you know, we're talking about Black Lives Matter. That's great, you know, but, you know, American Indians are every bit as endangered when meeting with the cops as black people. In fact, some say even more. Whatever.
Definitely.
It's
so many.
Sad.
And it is.
Anyway, so Friday, it's the 45th anniversary of the incident of Oglala. Oglala was a town where it's not even really a town, it's kind of like this scrub brush, ramble down, you know, like kind of house. It's not even there anymore, where the agents were killed on June 26, 45 years ago. We're going to do like a candlelight vigil, hold up some signs, hand out some flyers, you know, and I'll give you the latest news on Leonard, is that two congresspeople, one, Deb Hollins, she's from New Mexico, Roe Grijalva, G like in good, R-I-J-A-L-V-A, Roe Grijalva, they sent letters to Trump asking that Leonard Peltier, who's about 75 himself now, be released because we don't want him to get COVID. I recommend people look up Leonard. You can write him letters. He's in Coleman Prison Camp in Florida. You know, you can write to Trump. I mean, Trump, let's face it, Trump hates the FBI. So that alone might get him to release Leonard. I mean, if we could raise $2 million and slip him under the table, you know, greedy Trump, you don't care. He could release Leonard. But I don't think that's going to happen. You never know. So you can write to the president, call him up, ask him to free Leonard Peltier. And please, if you have the time, 7 to 9, Union Square, New York City, come to the vigil. Friday, June 26th. Bronx, Queens.
And you could also go to the Jericho website that features Leonard Peltier.
That's right.
Thanks again. Next, Sister Betty.
Okay, we're going to try and reach Brother Tom. We missed him last week. We're so glad he's back with us again this week. Brother Tom, your mic is open, and Gil, hang in there.
Thank you very much. I'd like to recite the words to Imagine, a song composed by John Lennon that is especially relevant during the Black Lives Matter protests. John Lennon composed the music in 1971. Its lyrics were largely written by his wife, Yoko Ono. On December 8th, 1981, Lennon was patent by Mark David Chapman. He accused Lennon and Imagine as being blasphemous. Chapman was arrested and sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. He has never been granted parole. Yoko Ono, who still lives in the Dakota, put a mosaic with the word Imagine in a place called Strawberry Fields near the entrance to the park on West 72nd Street. I live two blocks from the Dakota and witnessed the outpouring of grief by thousands right after Lennon's murder. I often go to Strawberry Fields to relax. Rolling Stone magazine named Imagine the second most popular record of all time. Imagine has been an inspiration to millions throughout the world. So let me get the the lyrics. I'll be with you in 1 second. Sorry for the here we go. Okay. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or possessions. Imagine if you can. I hope that someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. Thank you.
Well, let there be no doubt that those words are inspirational, as shown by Tom's rendition of Imagine. Thank you again for that, Tom Syracuse. And I know that many people just like you have been very much inspired by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Next up, Gil Obler from the Free Momia Coalition.
Hi, I'm actually coming on the radio today as Paul Gilboy, so it makes sense that I followed Paul Gilman. But I'm also known as Gil Obler and by some people as Spartacus Trehald. I'm going to talk about Momia in a second, but I also, as people know, work with the Green Party and with the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. So first I'm just going to comment on Paul's statement. I agreed with most of it, But O'Malley taught me, so and what he, one of the things he taught me is that, you know, even though he's demanding for the African people reparations, he doesn't want 40 acres and a mule because the land on Turtle Island is owned not by white people or black people, but by the indigenous peoples. So I'm quibbling only with the part where Paul said that the FBI had jurisdiction on that land. In any case, one other thing before I talk about Mumia, there's some things blowing up in the Green Party, and I wrote a piece on race and gender today, but I may or may – I forwarded it to you, Betty, and I may or may not read that on the air next week. So that's a teaser. Anyway, as far as Mumia, the big thing going on right now, we're still waiting for the legal issues to get moved forward. You know, he's been granted a new trial, but the dates are completely unclear. But this July 4th, we always have a big demonstration in Philadelphia, and this year is no exception. this year it's exciting because the Mumia movement, the political prisoner movement, is going to be joined by a group working on the BLM protests. So our numbers are going to be magnified, and it's really, really exciting that they're joining with the political prisoner movement for the July 4th demos. Normally we would be putting together a bus to go down there, but in the current COVID environment, we think nobody wants to get on a bus. Enclosed air, et cetera, et cetera. So instead, we're trying to organize carpools to go down there July 4th to Philadelphia. Don't have the details yet from the folks in Philly, but that will be coming shortly. However, if people will, we should have them on the air next week. And also, if people want to don't have transportation to get down there on their own and want to get involved in the carpool as a rider, or if you have a car and can provide transportation, the idea being that it's safer to have two or three people in a car with the windows open than a bus. So you can still use the email address bus@freemumia.com to contact me and get involved in the carpool, like I said, either as a rider or as a provider. You know, people who it's understandable if you're in quarantine and don't want to go to Philadelphia. There are other ways to support it from home or from New York, but if you can come to Philadelphia on July 4th, please write me again at bus@freemumia.com. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Gil. In the words of Reverend Pinckney, it's not about one thing, it's about everything. And we who are about everything, as we exercise an ability to join hands, to join organizations, to join demonstrations for real. Remembering what Aaron Dottie Roy said, demonstrations with no penalty or consequences are kind of irrelevant. We've been having a lot of demonstrations with no consequences, and I can see the heavy hand of the Democratic Party in Black Lives Matter, no demands, and the demand of defund the police was exploded very well by our Joel this evening, who gets to the heart of many of the discussions we have. Sister Betty.
We notice we have a number, the last four digits. Everybody, please, we know nowadays we don't memorize numbers. The last four digits are 4161. Did you want to make a comment before we open up all the microphones for the end of the program? It's a 212 number, the last four digits, 4161. Did you want to make a comment? You don't have to. It's all right if you're listening. That's what this program is about. But if you wanted to make a comment, your mic is open.
Hearing no response, let's move on.
Okay, we're going to open up all of the mics, so we have a little extra time. We sort of put pressure on people to so we could get everybody in without too much stress for the last person to speak. If 4161 does not wish to speak up, We're opening up the mics. And one thing I am concerned about is, as Brother Gil pointed out, and Brother Paul, the whole issue of how we organize. And one of the reasons why when we do workshops or panels or fundraisers, we invite the constituencies of every single political prisoner is because we all have one common oppressor. And that's what our theme is tonight, that this protest around what happened to George Floyd is not just about that particular incident. Ralph calls it a perfect storm. And we would like to open up your mics, and all mics are open. If anybody wants to throw in an extra comment on something, we would like you to jump in there before Ralph takes us home. Go ahead. Anyone want to speak yet? The mics are all open.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. I don't know if Ralph's comment was in response to me or not, but I may have misspoke. It's not the large Black Lives Matter movement which is joining us in Philadelphia. It's a group, probably a more radical group that's working on that, that's local. And I don't actually know the group, so that's why I didn't really have specific information about them, because I just learned about all this from the folks in Philly. So it's really my misspeaking more than anything else. But I trust that the group that Pam chose to work with is considerably more radical than the larger Black Lives Matter group itself.
My comment was certainly not directed at you or the Mumia movement. I just mentioned that reality that there are problems with finances, who's financing, and so much of the Black Lives Matter, and that Democratic Party who's trying to out-Republican the Republican.
I totally agree with you, and so I wasn't being defensive. I just wanted to make sure I spoke correctly.
Can I speak, Brother Ralph? This is Belinda with Louisiana United International. Hello?
Yes, give us your word.
Yes, I just want to say that, you know, I think, you know, that this is so important that we all understand, you know, what it's going to take in order for us to win. You know, you are absolutely right. There are infiltrators out here that are, you know, trying to, you know, deter and conceal and sabotage this type of movement. And, you know, I have experienced that firsthand, you know, since George Floyd's death, that they want to steal the narrative and control, you know, how things are supposed to unfold, how things are supposed to go in regards to the outcry. And I think Sister Betty said it best, you know, we don't want to use certain words like riot and, you know, and all of these things. We want to use, this is the outcry, this is the you know, a cry from the hearts and the depths of the people that are saying that we are fed up and that we are not going to take this type of treatment anymore. So, you know, and you're right, Brother Ralph, you know, it's got people out here that have been picked and paid, you know, that look like us. I'm talking Black people that are not for us. And they, all they're trying to do is wait until pretty much they have already set the time and the date on how long the emotions are going to, you know, be at the hype and how long, you know, everybody are going to, you know, be excited, you know, have this outcry. And they have already set the time and the date when it's all going to die down and that they're going to be able to put us right back in the same state and condition that we were in before George Floyd. Floyd's death. So you're absolutely right. This is not just about George Floyd's death. This is about the fact that people are fed up and we're not going to take this type of treatment anymore, and that we all are going to have to work together, the ones that will unite with us, because everybody is not going to unite with us. So we got to make that clear, and we got to support one another. We got to stick together. First of all, we got to identify, you know, people like the Jericho movement, you know, that's been around and fighting a good fight and the real fight, you know, like Louisiana United International. You know, we're fighting for the freedom, the freedom of thousands of people. And what we're saying is that nobody is free until everybody is free. So I don't care who's being paid, picked, and bought off, they're not going to interrupt the fact that we're fighting and we're not going to stop. So thank you so much for allowing me to share. And we're going to win.
We will win.
I'd like to share on that.
Go ahead. Who
Hi, it's Dolores.
Dolores.
I just want to say that I find it very interesting now that all of a sudden there's more talk about reparations. You know, that's surfacing. And, you know, I went to the Institute for the Black World website, and they're talking about the H.R. 40 bill regarding reparations. And, you know, this is something that this country has been forestalling, you know, for hundreds of years. And I find it very interesting that the protests now have had this, has caused this talk about reparations resurfacing. And you can create change with protests, but why is it necessary? Why does it take so long? And it's because the will isn't there. You know, and I don't see anything being accomplished with this reparations bill, this H.R. 40. And I remember when we had affirmative action, and I saw that as some form of reparations. But who did it benefit? White women, affirmative action. You know, so, you know, I just wanted to know what some people feel about this whole talk about reparations resurfacing. You know,
yes, well,
I think it's a good thing.
Resurfacing,
yeah, I think it's a good thing
for the umpteenth time.
Well, thank you so much.
You can't have change in America until we deal with reparations and make it happen. And don't tell me we can't pay it now, because we just saw with a swipe of a pen, we have spent $10 trillion. On junk, okay? We gave $10 trillion to a bunch of criminals on Wall Street, and we let them run as fast as they could. Stock market is going through the roof today, okay?
Yes,
while the rest of us have lost our jobs. So I don't ever want to hear again that we don't have enough money for reparations, or we don't have money for college. And we absolutely do have to do the reparations, because you want to know something? It's like sleeping with a pea under your mattress. No one is going to be able to sleep until they get that pee out from under their mattress. And we have to do something to acknowledge what happened. And the fair thing and the best way to acknowledge it is financially, giving it back what we can, at least doing that. You can't bring back the people that died. You can't take away the terrible scourge of oppression and cruelty. But you know what? You can put some dollars in people's pockets. And we have done it before. We have done it for Japan, and we forced Germany to do it, and we can certainly do it here. Never, ever tell me how we don't have the money. And I just want to say one more thing about the movement that's going on now. You know, George Floyd was a catapult, but the movement didn't happen just because of George Floyd. And the movement will continue to grow because everyone is so pissed off. After being locked up for 3 months in your house, being told you can't go anywhere, everybody lost their job, and I guarantee you, in 4 months from now, we are going to have a depression, because this can't be like this with no repercussions, okay? So there's going to be a lot of anger. And even if you see this movement fizzle out for a little while right now, it's going to come right back up there. And I think maybe just people, especially young people, are starting to put together that class issues and race issues are together. They go together. And that we have to fight as a united front. If you don't fight as a united front, you're going to continue to lose, because every time they separate and divide us, they conquer us as well. And I think what was impressive about the movement this time is a lot of young people. I see that 70% of the people, they said, the kids were white. Well, so they're getting something. They're getting a little – they've got some more information than other people had. And they're joining up, and they're fired up. And I think that millennials have really suffered so much more than most people know. I mean, they don't get offered any jobs that pay more than $15 an hour. They get crap jobs. They have $350,000 worth of debt on their back the minute they walk out of the college. They've got no security in their life. And you know what? They got nothing to lose by hitting the streets. Not one thing to lose. They have only something to gain. And when they see Donald Trump swiping off check after check to these goddamn criminals, I think they know there's something that they can fight for, and there's something that is worth fighting for. So I do think the movement will keep going. And I also want to say to everybody here who was a part of the movement in the 60s, what you own is you own that leadership that you had from your experience. And I thought the thing that was lacking here was the kids had the physical power to take the streets, but they seemed to get a little lost at what direction to go in next. And in my opinion, the next direction to hit in New York City was Eric Garner. If you do not solve Eric Garner, we cannot go forward. We must solve that case, because that case was never solved. There's no jeopardy attached to anything that happened with Eric Garner. You can still try that officer and the 11 people that helped him to kill Eric Garner. They can all be charged. And until you do that, you can't do anything. I don't want to hear that butthead, de Blasio, down there acting like he has amnesia, doesn't understand what happened here. I don't want to hear about Floyd. I want to hear about Eric Garner, and I want these kids now to take their movement. They need to drive this movement over to the Eric Garner stop. That's the first stop. And then we need to hit every single one of the murders that happened. And once we start handling this and doling out some justice, then you're going to start to see things level off, and people are going to be getting more. They're going to feel more comfortable, and they're going to go for more. But I also just want to say one last thing about Trump, and that is, as much as I despise that piece of crap, it's amazing how much change has happened under President Trump. Now, it didn't happen in the way I wanted it to happen. It didn't happen with a hero like President Roosevelt coming in and doing all these great things. It happened because we have a demon dictator in office, and people have so much hatred towards them that they're willing to do anything to move against them. So even the TV stations hate him so much that they're willing to actually put people that I never thought would make it onto regular TV. I never thought I would see these people that have been on WBAI for years, but how the hell did the TV stations find them? But there they were, sitting on the TV stations. So apparently they did know about them all along. So in a way, it's a really bizarre thing. But if you want change, we might just have to stay with Trump to get the change we need, because he's a catapult in another direction. I'm going to leave it there, guys.
Let me say this. I don't give a damn about Trump. It is not Trump. It is the history of America. He's calling up that history.
And that's right.
It's amazing how many people he can call on. But understand this. It's not about Trump. It's about the American system, where the capitalists are supporting the capitalists. And let us not jump from the frying pan into the fire. Let's recognize the Democrats are the fire. Let's recognize that before we get so deeply involved in reparations, let's stop them from stealing from us today. That is about the funds that the government is giving out. Who do they go to? Let's stop that. Let's stop the stealing of the funds from the black community in education. $30 billion. It's being stolen. And we're talking about money that was stolen 150 years ago. But if we stop them from stealing from us today, we will have a much improved society, and people can organize around stopping the stealing, because that's about all of us. And as for reparations, I always say our problems never go beyond a generation. second generation keeps fighting the same same problems the last generation did. Let us get it together and make real change, my brothers and sisters. And I'd like this program to be a part of it. Thank you so much for joining us. Sister Betty, take us home.
I hope you guys can come back and continue this discussion next week. You were awesome. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Thank you.
Good night, Betty. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.